5 seconds to translation, Father. Morpurgo looked across the bridge and locked eyes with his son. Projections behind the young man showed the portal growing, growing, surrounding. I love you, said the general. 263 singularity containment spheres, connecting more than 72 million Farcaster portals, were destroyed within 2.6 seconds of one another. Force fleet units, deployed by Morpurgo under executive order, and reacting to orders unsealed less than 3 minutes before, reacted promptly and professionally, destroying the fragile Farcaster spheres by missile, lance, and plasma explosive. 3 seconds later, with the clouds of debris still expanding, the hundreds of Force spacecraft found themselves stranded, separated from each other and any other system by weeks or months via Hawking Drive and years of time debt. Thousands of people were caught in Farcaster transit. Many died instantly, dismembered or torn in half. Many more suffered amputated limbs as the portals collapsed behind them or before them. Some simply disappeared. This was the fate of the HS Stephen Hawking. Precisely as planned, as both entrance and exit portals were expertly destroyed in the nanosecond of the ship's translation. No part of the torch ship survived in real space. Later tests showed conclusively that the so-called death wand device was detonated in whatever passed for time and space in the strange core geographies between the portals. The effect was never known. The effect on the rest of the web and its citizens was immediately obvious. After 7 centuries of existence, and at least 4 centuries where few citizens existed without it, the datasphere, including the all-thing and all-com and access bands, simply ceased to be. Hundreds of thousands of citizens went insane at that moment, shocked into catatonia by the disappearance of senses which had become more important to them than sight or hearing. More hundreds of thousands of datum plane operators, including many of the so-called cyber pukes and system cowboys, were lost, their analog personas caught in the crash of the datasphere, or their brains burned out by neural shunt overload, or an effect later known as zero-zero feedback. Millions of people died when their chosen habitats, accessible only by Farcaster, became isolated death traps. The bishop of the Church of the Final Atonement, the leader of the Shrike cult, had carefully arranged to sit out the final days in some comfort in a hollowed-out mountain, lavishly stocked, deep in the Raven Range of the north reaches of Nevermore. Redundant Farcasters were the only route in or out. The bishop perished with several thousand of his acolytes, exorcists, lectors, and ostiaries, clawing to get into the inner sanctum to share the last of the Holy One's air. Millionaire publisher Tyrena Wingreen Fife, 97 standard years old and on the scene for 300-plus years thanks to the miracle of Poulsen treatments and cryogenics, made the mistake of spending that fateful day in her Farcaster access-only office on the 435th floor of the Transline Spire in the Babel section of Tau Ceti Center's City 5. After 15 hours of refusing to believe that Farcaster's service would not be renewed shortly, Tyrena gave in to calm call entreaties from her employees and dropped her containment field walls so that she could be picked up by EMV. Tyrena had not listened to instructions carefully enough. The explosive decompression blew her off the 435th floor like a cork out of an overshaken champagne bottle. Employees and rescue squad members in the waiting EMV swore that the old lady cursed a blue streak for the entire 4-minute fall. On most worlds, chaos had earned a new definition. The majority of the web's economy disappeared with the local dataspheres and the web megasphere. Trillions of hard-earned and ill-gotten marks ceased to be. Universal cards quit functioning. The machinery of daily life coughed, wheezed, and shut down. For weeks or months or years, depending upon the world, it would be impossible to pay for groceries, charge a ride on public transit, settle the simplest debt, or receive services without access to black market coins and bills. But the web-wide depression, which had hit like a tsunami, was a minor detail, reserved for later pondering. For most families, the effect was immediate and intensely personal. Father or mother had cast off to work as usual, say from Deneb Vier to Renaissance V, and instead of arriving home an hour late this evening, would be delayed 11 years. If he or she could find immediate transit on one of the few Hawking Drive spin ships still traveling the hard way between the worlds. Well-to-do family members, listening to Gladstone's speech in their fashionable multi-world residence, looked up to stare at each other, separated by only a few meters and open portals between the rooms, blinked, and were separated by light years and actual years, their rooms now opening into nothing. Children a few minutes away at school or camp or play or the sitters would be grown before they were reunited with parents. The grand concourse, already slightly truncated by the winds of war, found itself blown to oblivion. Its endless belt of beautiful shops and prestige restaurants sliced into tawdry sections never to be reunited. The river Tethys ceased to flow as the giant portals went opaque and died. Water spilled out, dried up, and left fish to rot under 200 suns. There were riots. Lucis tore itself apart like a wolf chewing at its own entrails. New Mecca went into spasms of martyrdom. Tsingtao Siswang Pana celebrated deliverance from the ouster hordes and then hanged several thousand former hegemony bureaucrats. Maui Covenant also rioted, but in celebration, the hundreds of thousands of descendants of the first families riding the Motal Isles to displace the off-worlders who had taken over so much of the world. Later, the millions of shocked and displaced vacation home owners were put to work dismantling the thousands of oil derricks and tourist centers which had spotted the equatorial archipelago like pox. On Renaissance Vector, there was a brief spurt of violence followed by efficient social restructuring and a serious effort to feed an urban world without farms. On Nordholm, the cities emptied as people returned to the coasts and the cold sea and their ancestral fishing boats. On Parvati, there was confusion and civil war. On Sol Draconi Septim, there was jubilation and revolution, followed by a new strand of retrovirus plague. On Fuji, there was philosophical resignation, followed by an immediate construction of orbital shipyards to create a fleet of Hawking Drive spin ships. On Asquith, there was finger-pointing, followed by the victory of the Socialist Labor Workers' Party in the World Parliament. On Pachim, there was prayer. The new pope, His Holiness Teilhard I, called a great council into session. Vatican 39 announced a new era in the life of the Church and empowered the council to prepare missionaries for long voyages. Many missionaries for many voyages. Pope Teilhard announced that these missionaries would not be proselytizers, but searchers. The Church, like so many species grown used to living on the edge of extinction, adapted and endured. On Tempe, there were riots and death and the rise of demagogues. On Mars, the Olympus Command stayed in touch with its far-flung forces for a while via Fatline. It was Olympus which confirmed that the ouster invasion waves everywhere but Hyperion system had simply limped to a halt. Intercepted core ships were empty and unprogrammed. The invasion was over. On Metaxas, there were riots and reprisals. On Qum Riyad, a self-appointed fundamentalist Shiite Ayatollah rode out of the desert, called 100,000 followers to him, and wiped out the Sunni Home Rule government within hours. The new revolutionary government returned power to the mullahs and set back the clock 2,000 years. the people rioted with joy. On Armagast, a frontier world, things went on pretty much as they always had, except for a dearth of tourists, new archaeologists, and other imported luxuries. Armagast was a labyrinthine world. The labyrinth there stayed empty. On Hebron there was panic in the off-world center of New Jerusalem. But the Zionist elders soon restored order to the city and world. Plans were made. Rare off-world necessities were rationed and shared. The desert was reclaimed. Farms were extended. Trees were planted. The people complained to each other, thanked God for deliverance, argued with God about the discomfort of that same deliverance, and went about their business. On God's grove, entire continents still burned, and a pall of smoke filled the air. Soon after the last of the swarm had passed, scores of tree ships rose through the clouds, climbing slowly on fusion thrusters while shielded by erg-generated containment fields. Once beyond the gravity well, most of these tree ships turned outward, in a myriad of directions along the galactic plane of the ecliptic, and began the long spin-up to quantum leap. Fat-line squirts leaped from tree ship to distant waiting swarms. The receding had begun. On Tau Ceti Center, seat of power and wealth and business and government, the hungry survivors left the dangerous spires and useless cities and helpless orbiting habitats and went in search of someone to blame, someone to punish. They did not have far to look. General von Zeit had been in Government House when the portals failed, and now he commanded the 200 Marines and 68 security people left to guard the complex. Former CEO Mayna Gladstone still commanded the 6 Praetorians Kolchev had left her when he and the other ranking senators had departed on the first and last force evacuation dropship to get through. Somewhere, the mob had acquired anti-space missiles and lances, and none of the other 3,000 Government House employees and refugees would be going anywhere until the siege was lifted or the shields failed. Gladstone stood at the forward observation post and watched the carnage. The mob had destroyed most of Deer Park and the formal gardens before the last lines of interdiction and containment fields had stopped them. There were at least 3 million frenzied people pressed against those barriers now, and the mob grew larger every minute. "Can you drop the fields back 50 meters and restore them before the mob covers the ground?" Gladstone asked the general. Smoke filled the sky from the cities burning to the west. Thousands of men and women had been smashed against the blur of containment field by the throngs behind them, until the lower 2 meters of the shimmering wall looked as if it had been painted with strawberry jam. Tens of thousands more pressed closer to that inner shield, despite the agony of nerve and bone the interdiction field was causing them.
"We can't do that, M-Executive," said von Zeit. "But why?"
"I'm going out to talk to them." Gladstone sounded very tired. The Marine looked at her, sure that she was making some bad joke.
"M-Executive, in a month they will be willing to listen to you, or any of us, on radio or HTV. In a year, maybe two, after orders restored and rationing successful, they might be ready to forgive. But it will be a generation before they really understand what you did, that you saved them. Saved us all."
"I want to talk to them," said Mayna Gladstone. "I have something to give to them." Van Zeit shook his head and looked at the circle of force officers who had been staring out at the mob through slits in the bunker and who now were staring at Gladstone with equal disbelief and horror.
"I'd have to check with CEO Kolchev," said General von Zeit.
"No," Mayna Gladstone said tiredly. "He rules an empire which no longer exists. I still rule the world I destroyed." She nodded toward her Praetorians, and they produced death wands from their orange and black striped tunics. None of the force officers moved. General von Zeit said,
"Mayna, the next evacuation ship will make it."
Gladstone nodded as if distracted. The inner garden, I should think. The mob will be at a loss for several moments. The withdrawal of the outer fields will throw them off balance. She looked around as if she might be forgetting something, and then extended her hand to von Zeit. Goodbye, Mark. Thank you. Please take care of my people. Von Zeit shook her hand and watched as the woman adjusted her scarf, absently touched a bracelet comm log as if for luck, and went out of the bunker with four of her Praetorians. The small group crossed the trampled gardens and walked slowly toward the containment fields. The mob beyond seemed to react like a single, mindless organism, pressing through the violet interdiction field and screaming with the voice of some demented thing. Gladstone turned, raised one hand as if to wave, and gestured her Praetorians back. The four guards hurried across the matted grass.
"Do it,"
said the oldest of the remaining Praetorians. He pointed to the containment field control remote.
"Fuck you,"
General von Zeit said clearly. No one would go near that remote while he lived. Von Zeit had forgotten that Gladstone still had access to codes and tactical tight beam links. He saw her raise her comm log, but he reacted too slowly. Lights on the remote blinked red and then green. The outer fields winked out and then reformed 50 meters closer in. And for a second, Mayna Gladstone stood alone, with nothing between her and the mob of millions, except a few meters of grass, and countless corpses suddenly surrendered to gravity by the retreating shield walls. Gladstone raised both arms as if embracing the mob. Silence and lack of motion extended for 3 eternal seconds. And then the mob roared with the voice of a single great beast, and thousands surged forward with sticks and rocks and knives and broken bottles. For a moment, it seemed to von Zeit that Gladstone stood like an impervious rock against that tidal wave of rabble. He could see her dark suit and bright scarf, see her standing upright, her arms still raised, but then more hundreds surged in, the crowd closed, and the CEO was lost. The Praetorians lowered their weapons and were put under immediate arrest by Marine sentries.
"We'll pick the containment fields," ordered von Zeit. "Tell the dropships to land in the inner garden at 5-minute intervals. Hurry!"
The general turned away.
"Good Lord,"
said Theo Lane, as the fragmented reports kept coming in over the fat line. There were so many millisecond squirts being sent that the computer could do little to separate them. The result was a mélange of madness.
"Play back the destruction of the Singularity containment sphere," said the consul.
"Yes, sir," said the ship, and interrupted its fat-line messages for a replay of the sudden burst of white, followed by a brief blossoming of debris and sudden collapse as the Singularity swallowed itself and everything within a 6,000-click radius. Instruments showed the effect of gravity tides, easily adjusted for at this distance, but playing havoc with the hegemony and ouster ships still locked in battle closer to Hyperion.
"All right," said the consul, and the rush of fatline reports resumed. "There's no doubt?" asked Arendez.
"None," said the consul.
"Hyperion is an outback world again. Only this time there is no web to be outback to."
"It's so hard to believe," said Theo Lane.
The ex-governor-general sat drinking scotch, the only time the consul had ever seen his aide indulge in a drug. Theo poured another 4 fingers.
"The web. Gone. 500 years of expansion wiped out."
"Not wiped out," said the consul.
He set his own drink, still unfinished, on a table.
"The worlds remain. The cultures will grow apart, but we still have the Hawking drive. The one technological advance we gave ourselves, rather than leased from the Corps."
Emilio Arendez leaned forward, his palms together as if praying.
"Can the Corps really be gone? Destroyed?"
The consul listened a moment to the babble of voices, cries, entreaties, military reports, and pleas for help coming over the fat-line voice-only bands. Perhaps not destroyed, he said, but cut off, sealed away. Theo finished his drink and carefully set his glass down. His green eyes had a placid, glazed look.
You think there are other spider webs for them? Other Farcaster systems? Reserve cores?
The consul made a gesture with his hand.
We know they succeeded in creating their ultimate intelligence. Perhaps that UI allowed this winnowing of the core. Perhaps it's kept some of the old AIs online, in a reduced capacity, the way they had planned to keep a few billion humans in reserve.
Suddenly, the fat line babble ceased, as if cut off by a knife.
Ship? Queried the council, suspecting a power failure somewhere in the receiver.
All fat line messages have ceased, most in mid-transmission, said the ship. The consul felt his heart pounding as he thought. The Death Wand device.
But no, he realized at once. That couldn't affect all of the worlds at once.
Even with hundreds of such devices detonating simultaneously, there would be lag time as four ships and other far-flung transmission sources got in their final messages.
But what then?
The messages appear to have been cut off by a disturbance in the transmission medium, said the ship, which is, to my current knowledge, impossible. The consul stood.
A disturbance in the transmission medium?
The fat line medium, as far as humans understood it, was the hyperstring Planck-infinite topography of space-time itself, what AIs had cryptically referred to as the void which binds. There could be no disturbance in that medium.
Suddenly the ship said, Fatline message coming in, transmission source everywhere, encryption base infinite, squirt rate, real time.
The consul opened his mouth to tell the ship to quit spouting nonsense when the air above the hollow pit misted in something neither image nor data column, and a voice spoke.
There will be no further misuse of this channel. You are disturbing others who are using it to serious purpose. Access will be restored when you understand what it is for. Goodbye.
The three men sat in silence, unbroken except for the reassuring rush of ventilator fans and the myriad soft noises of a ship underway. Finally, the consul said,
Ship, please send out a standard fatline time location squirt without encoding. Add, receiving stations respond.
There was a pause of seconds, an impossibly long response time for the AI-caliber computer that was the ship.
I'm sorry, that is not possible, it said at last.
Why not? Demanded the consul.
Fatline transmissions are no longer being allowed. The hyperstring medium is no longer receptive to modulation.
There's nothing on the fatline? Asked Theo, staring at the empty space above the hollow pit, as if someone had turned off a holly just as it was getting to the exciting part.
Again the ship paused. To all intents and purposes, M. Lane, it said. There is no fat line any longer.
Jesus wept, muttered the consul.
He finished his drink in one long gulp and went to the bar for another.
It's the old Chinese curse, he muttered.
Emilio Arendez looked up.
What's that?
The consul took a long drink.
Old Chinese curse, he said.
May you live in interesting times.
As if compensating for the loss of Fatline, the ship played audio of in-system radio and intercepted tight beam babble while it projected a real-time view of the blue and white sphere of Hyperion, turning and growing as they decelerated toward it at 200 gravities.
45.
I escape the web datasphere just before escape ceases to be an option. It is incredible and oddly disturbing, the sight of the megasphere swallowing itself. Braun Lamia's view of the megasphere as an organic thing, a semi-sentient organism more analogous to an ecology than a city, was essentially correct. Now, as the Farcaster links cease to be and the world inside those avenues folds and collapses upon itself, the external datasphere simultaneously collapsing, like a burning big-top tent, suddenly without poles, wires, guys, or stakes, The living megasphere devours itself like some ravenous predator gone mad, chewing its own tail, belly, entrails, forepaws, and heart, until only the mindless jaws are left, snapping on emptiness. The metasphere remains, but it is more wilderness than ever now. Black forests of unknown time and space, sounds in the night, lions, and tigers, and bears. When the void which binds convulses and sends its single, banal message to the human universe, it is as if an earthquake has sent ripples through solid rock. Hurrying through the shifting metasphere above Hyperion, I have to smile. It is as if the god analog has grown tired of the ants scribbling graffiti on its big toe. I don't see God, either one of them, in the metasphere. I don't try. I have enough problems of my own. The black vortexes of the web and core entrances are gone now, erased from space and time like warts removed, vanished as thoroughly as whirlpools in water when the storm has passed. I am stuck here, unless I want to brave the metasphere. Which I do not. Not yet. But this is where I want to be. The datasphere is all but gone here in Hyperion system. The pitiful remnants on the world itself, and in what remains of the Force fleet, drying up like tide pools in the sun. But the time tombs glow through the metasphere like beacons in the gathering darkness. If the Farcaster links had been black vortexes, the tombs blazed like white holes shedding an expanding light. I move toward them. So far, as the one who comes before, all I have accomplished is to appear in others' dreams. It is time to do something. Saul waited. It had been hours since he had handed his only child to the Shrike. It had been days since he had eaten or slept. Around him the storm had raged and abated. The tombs had glowed and rumbled like runaway reactors, and the time tides had whipped him with tsunami force. But Saul had clung to the stone steps of the Sphinx and waited through it all. He waited now. Half-conscious, pummeled by fatigue and fear for his daughter, Saul found that his scholar's mind was working at a rapid pace. For most of his life and for all of his career, Saul Weintraub, the historian come classicist come philosopher, had dealt with the ethics of human religious behavior. Religion and ethics were not always, or even frequently, mutually compatible. The demands of religious absolutism or fundamentalism or rampaging relativism often reflected the worst aspects of contemporary culture or prejudices, rather than a system which both man and God could live under with a sense of real justice. Saul's most famous book, finally titled Abraham's Dilemma when it was brought out in a mass-market edition in numbers he had never dreamed of while producing volumes for academic presses, had been written when Rachel was dying of Merlin's sickness and dealt, obviously enough, with Abraham's hard choice of obeying or disobeying God's direct command for him to sacrifice his son. Saul had written that primitive times had required primitive obedience, that later generations evolved to the point where parents offered themselves as sacrifice, as in the dark nights of the ovens which pocked old Earth history, and that current generations had to deny any command for sacrifice. Saul had written that whatever form God now took in human consciousness, whether as a mere manifestation of the subconscious in all its revanchist needs, or as a more conscious attempt at philosophical and ethical evolution, humankind could no longer agree to offer up sacrifice in God's name. Sacrifice and the agreement to sacrifice had written human history in blood. Yet hours ago, ages ago, Saul Weintraub had handed his only child to a creature of death. For years the voice in his dreams had commanded him to do so. For years Saul had refused. He had agreed, finally, only when time was gone, when any other hope was gone, and when he had realized that the voice in his and Sarai's dreams all those years had not been the voice of God, nor of some dark force allied with the Shrike. It had been the voice of their daughter. With a sudden clarity which went beyond the immediacy of his pain or sorrow, Saul Weintraub suddenly understood perfectly why Abraham had agreed to sacrifice Isaac, his son, when the Lord commanded him to do so. It was not obedience. It was not even to put the love of God above the love of his son. Abraham was testing God. By denying the sacrifice at the last moment, by stopping the knife, God had earned the right in Abraham's eyes and the hearts of his offspring to become the God of Abraham. Saul shuddered as he thought of how no posturing on Abraham's part, no shamming of his willingness to sacrifice the boy, could have served to forge that bond between greater power and humankind. Abraham had to know in his own heart that he would kill his son. The deity, whatever form it then took, had to know Abraham's determination, had to feel that sorrow and commitment to destroy what was to Abraham the most precious thing in the universe. Abraham came not to sacrifice, but to know once and for all whether this God was a God to be trusted and obeyed. No other test would do. Why then, thought Saul, clinging to the stone stair as the Sphinx seemed to rise and fall on the storm seas of time, why was this test being repeated? What terrible new revelations lay at hand for humankind? Saul understood then, from what little Bronn had told him, from the stories shared on the pilgrimage, from his own personal revelations of the past few weeks, that the effort of the machine ultimate intelligence, whatever the hell it was, to flush out the missing empathy entity of the human Godhead was useless. Saul no longer saw the tree of thorns on its clifftop, its metal branches in suffering multitudes. But he did see clearly now that the thing was as much an organic machine as the Shrike, an instrument to broadcast suffering through the universe, so the human God part would be forced to respond, to show itself. If God evolved, and Saul was sure that God must, then that evolution was toward empathy, toward a shared sense of suffering rather than power and dominion. But the obscene tree which the pilgrims had glimpsed, which poor Martin Silenus had been a victim of, was not the way to evoke the missing power. Saul realized now that the machine God, whatever its form, was insightful enough to see that empathy was a response to others' pain. But the same UI was too stupid to realize that empathy, in both human terms and the terms of humankind's UI, was far more than that. Empathy and love were inseparable and inexplicable. The machine UI would never understand it, not even enough to use it as a lure for the part of the human UI which had tired of warfare and the distant future. Love, that most banal of things, that most cliched of religious motivations, had more power, Saul now knew, than did strong nuclear force or weak nuclear force or electromagnetism or gravity. Love was these other forces, Saul realized. The void which binds, the sub-quantum impossibility that carried information from photon to photon, was nothing more or less than love. But could love, simple, banal love, explain the so-called anthropic principle which scientists had shaken their collective heads over for 7 centuries and more? That almost infinite string of coincidences which had led to a universe that had just the proper number of dimensions, just the correct values on electron, just the precise rules for gravity, just the proper age to stars, just the right pre-biologies to create just the perfect viruses, to become just the proper DNAs. In short, a series of coincidences so absurd in their precision and correctness that they defied logic, defied understanding, and even defied religious interpretation. Love? For 7 centuries, the existence of grand unification theories and hyperstring post-quantum physics and core-given understanding of the universe as self-contained and boundless, without Big Bang singularities or corresponding endpoints, had pretty much eliminated any role of God, primitively anthropomorphic or sophisticatedly post-Einsteinian, even as a caretaker or pre-creation former of rules. The modern universe, as machine and man had come to understand it, needed no creator, in fact allowed no creator. Its rules allowed very little tinkering and no major revisions. It had not begun and would not end, beyond cycles of expansion and contraction, as regular and self-regulated as the seasons on old Earth. No room for love there. It seemed that Abraham had offered to murder his son to test a phantom. It seemed that Saul had brought his dying daughter through hundreds of light years and innumerable hardships in response to nothing. But now, as the Sphinx loomed above him, and the first hint of sunrise paled Hyperion's sky, Saul realized that he had responded to a force more basic and persuasive than the Shrike's terror or Pain's dominion. If he was right, and he did not know but felt, then love was as hardwired into the structure of the universe as gravity and matter-antimatter. There was room for some sort of God, not in the web between the walls, nor in the singularity cracks in the pavement, nor somewhere out before and beyond the sphere of things, but in the very warp and woof of things, evolving as the universe evolved, learning as the learning-able parts of the universe learned, loving as humankind loved. Saul got to his knees and then to his feet. The time-tide storm seemed to have abated a bit, and he thought he could try for the 100th time to gain access to the tomb. Bright light still emanated from where the Shrike had emerged, taken Saul's daughter and vanished. But now the stars were disappearing as the sky itself lightened toward morning. Saul climbed the stairs. He remembered the time at home on Barnard's World when Rachel, she was 10, had tried to climb the town's tallest elm and had fallen when she was 5 meters from the top. Saul had rushed to the med center to find his child floating in the recovery nutrient and suffering from a punctured lung, a broken leg and ribs, a fractured jaw, and innumerable cuts and bruises. She had smiled at him, lifted a thumb, and said through her wired jaw,
"I'll make it next time."
Saul and Sarai had sat there in the med center that night while Rachel slept. They had waited for morning. Saul had held her hand through the night. He waited now. Time tides from the open entrance to the Sphinx still held Saul back like insistent winds, but he leaned into them like an immovable rock and stood there, 5 meters out and waiting, squinting into the glare. He glanced up but did not move back when he saw the fusion flame of a descending spacecraft slice the pre-dawn sky. He turned to look but did not retreat when he heard the spacecraft landing and saw 3 figures emerge. He glanced but did not step back when he heard other noises, shouts from deeper in the valley, and saw a familiar figure lugging another in a fireman's carry, moving toward him from beyond the jade tomb. None of these things related to his child. He waited for Rachel. Even without a datasphere, it is quite possible for my persona to travel through the rich void which binds soup which now surrounds Hyperion. My immediate reaction is to want to visit the one who will be, but although that one's brilliance dominates the metasphere, I am not yet ready for that. I am, after all, little John Keats, not John the Baptist. The Sphinx, a tomb patterned after a real creature that will not be designed by genetic engineers for centuries to come, is a maelstrom of temporal energies. There are really several sphinxes visible to my expanded sight. The anti-entropic tomb carrying its Shrike cargo back in time like some sealed container with its deadly bacillus. The active, unstable sphinx, which contaminated Rachel Weintraub in its initial effort to open a portal through time. and the Sphinx which has opened and is moving forward through time again. This last Sphinx is the blazing portal of light, which, second only to the one who will be, lights Hyperion with its metaspherical bonfire. I descend to this bright place in time to watch Saul Weintraub hand his daughter to the Shrike. I could not have interfered with this even if I had arrived earlier. I would not if I were able. Worlds beyond reason depend upon this act. But I await within the Sphinx for the Shrike to pass, carrying its tender cargo. Now I can see the child. She is seconds old, blotched, moist, and wrinkled. She is crying her newborn lungs out. From my old attitudes of bachelorhood and reflective poet stance, I find it hard to understand the attraction this bawling, unaesthetic infant exerts on its father and the cosmos. Still, the sight of a baby's flesh, however unattractive this newborn might be, held by the Shrike's bladed talons, stirs something in me. 3 paces into the Sphinx have carried the Shrike and the child hours forward in time. Just beyond the entrance, the river of time accelerates. If I don't do something within seconds, it will be too late. The Shrike will have used this portal to carry the child off to whatever distant future dark hole it seeks. Unbidden, the images arrive of spiders draining their victims of fluids, of digger wasps burying their own larvae in the paralyzed bodies of their prey, perfect sources for incubation and food. I have to act, but I have no more solidity here than I had in the core. The Shrike walks through me as if I were an unseen hollow. My analog persona is useless here, armless and insubstantial as a wisp of swamp gas. But swamp gas has no brain, and John Keats did. The Shrike takes another 2 steps, and more hours pass for Saul and the others outside. I can see blood on the crying infant's skin where the Shrike's scalpeled fingers have cut into flesh. To hell with this. Outside, on the broad stone porch of the Sphinx, caught now in the flood of temporal energies flowing in and through the tomb, lay backpacks, blankets, abandoned food containers, and all the detritus Saul and the pilgrims have left there, including a single Mobius cube. The box had been sealed with a Class 8 containment field on the Templar tree ship Yggdrasil when Voice of the Tree Het Mastin had prepared for his long voyage. It contained a single Urg, sometimes known as a binder, one of the small creatures which might not be intelligent by human standards, but which had evolved around distant stars and developed the ability to control more powerful force fields than any machine known to humankind. The Templars and Ousters had communicated with the creatures for generations. Templars used them for control redundancy on their beautiful but exposed tree ships. Het Mastin had brought this thing hundreds of light years to complete the Templar agreement with the Church of the Final Atonement to help fly the Shrike's thorn tree. But seeing the Shrike and the Tree of Torment, Mastin had not been able to fulfill the contract, and so he died. The Mobius cube remained. The Urg was visible to me as a constrained sphere of red energy in the temporal flood. Outside, through a curtain of darkness, Saul Weintraub was just visible, a sadly comic figure, speeded up like a silent film figure by the subjective rush of time beyond the Sphinx's temporal field. But the Mobius cube lay within the Sphinx's circle. Rachel cried with the fear even a newborn can know, fear of falling, fear of pain, fear of separation. The Shrike took a step, and another hour was lost to those outside. I was insubstantial to the Shrike, but energy fields are something which even we core analog ghosts can touch. I canceled the Mobius cube's containment field. I freed the Urg. Templars communicate with Urgs via electromagnetic radiation, coded pulses, simple rewards of radiation when the creature does what they want, but primarily through a near-mystical form of contact which only the Brotherhood and a few Ouster exotics know. Scientists call it a crude telepathy. In truth, It is almost pure empathy. The Shrike takes another step into the opening portal to the future. Rachel cries with the energy only someone newly born to the universe can muster. The Erg expands, understands, and melds with my persona. John Keats takes on substance and form. I hurry the 5 paces to the Shrike, remove the baby from its hands, and step back. Even in the energy maelstrom that is the Sphinx, I can smell the infant newness of her as I hold the child against my chest and cup her moist head against my cheek. The Shrike whirls in surprise, 4 arms extend, blades snick open, and red eyes focus on me. But the creature is too close to the portal itself. Without moving, it recedes down the storm drain of temporal flow. The thing's steam shovel jaws open, steel teeth gnash, but it is already gone, a spot in the distance, something less. I turn toward the entrance, but it is too far. The Erg's draining energy could get me there, drag me upstream against the flow, but not with Rachel. Carrying another living thing that far against so much force is more than I can manage, even with the Erg's help. The baby cries, and I bounce her gently, whispering nonsense doggerel in her warm ear. If we can't go back and we can't go forward, we'll just wait here for a moment. Perhaps someone will come along. Martin Silenus's eyes widened, and Braun Lamia turned quickly, seeing the Shrike floating in midair above and behind her. "Holy shit," Braun whispered reverently. In the Shrike palace, tiers of sleeping human bodies receded in the gloom and distance. All of the people except Martin Silenus still connected to the Thorn Tree, the machine UI, and God knows what else by pulsing umbilicals. As if to show its power here, the Shrike had quit climbing, opened its arms, and floated up 3 meters until it hung in the air 5 meters out from the stone shelf where Braun crouched next to Martin Silenus.
"Do something," whispered Silenus.
The poet was no longer attached by the neural shunt umbilical, but he was still too weak to hold his head up.
"Ideas?" said Braun,
the brave remark somewhat ruined by the quaver in her voice.
"Trust," said a voice below them,
and Braun shifted to look down toward the floor. The young woman whom Braun had recognized as Moneta in Kassad's tomb stood far below.
"Help!" cried Braun.
"Trust," said Moneta,
and disappeared. The Shrike had not been distracted. It lowered its hands and stepped forward, as if walking on solid stone rather than air.
"Shit," whispered Braun.
"Ditto,"
rasped Martin Silenus.
"Out of the frying pan, back into the fucking fire."
"Shut up,"
said Braun. Then, as if to herself,
"Trust what? Who?"
"Trust the fucking Shrike to kill us or stick us both on the fucking tree," gasped Silenus.
He managed to move enough to clutch Braun's arm.
"Better dead than back on the tree, Braun."
Braun touched his hand briefly and stood, facing the Shrike across 5 meters of air.
"Trust?"
Braun held her foot out, felt around on emptiness, closed her eyes for a second, and opened them as her foot seemed to touch a solid step. She opened her eyes. Nothing was under her foot except air.
"Trust?"
Braun put her weight on her forward foot and stepped out, teetering a moment before bringing her other foot down. She and the Shrike stood facing each other, 10 meters above the stone floor. The creature seemed to grin at her as it opened its arms. Its carapace glowed dully in the dim light. Its red eyes were very bright.
"Trust?"
Feeling the adrenaline rush, Braun stepped forward on the invisible steps, gaining height as she moved into the Shrike's embrace. She felt the finger blades slicing through fabric and skin as the thing began to hug her to it, toward the curved blade growing out of its metal chest, toward the open jaws and rows of steel teeth. But while still standing firmly on thin air, Braun leaned forward and set her uninjured hand flat against the shrike's chest, feeling the coldness of the carapace, but also feeling a rush of warmth as energy rushed from her, out of her, through her. The blades stopped cutting before they cut anything but skin. The shrike froze as if the flow of temporal energy surrounding them had turned to a lump of amber. Braun set her hand on the thing's broad chest and pushed. The shrike froze completely in place, became brittle, the gleam of metal fading to be replaced by the transparent glow of crystal, the bright sheen of glass. Braun stood on air, being embraced by a 3-meter glass sculpture of the shrike. In its chest, where a heart might be, something that looked like a large black moth fluttered and beat sooty wings against the glass. Braun took a deep breath and pushed again. The shrike slid backward on the invisible platform she shared with it, teetered, and fell. Braun ducked under the encircling arms, hearing and feeling her jacket tearing as the still sharp finger blades caught in the material and ripped as the thing tumbled. And then she was teetering herself, flailing her good arm for balance, as the glass shrike turned 1.5 times in midair, struck the floor, and shattered into 1,000 jagged shards. Braun pivoted, fell to her knees on the invisible catwalk, and crawled back toward Martin Silenus. In the last half meter, her confidence failed her. The invisible support simply ceased to be, and she fell heavily, twisting her ankle as she hit the edge of the stone tier and managing to keep from falling off only by grabbing Silenus's knee. Cursing from the pain in her shoulder, broken wrist, twisted ankle, and lacerated palms and knees, she pulled herself to safety next to him.
"There's obviously been some weird shit going on since I left," Martin Silenus said hoarsely. "Can we go now? Or do you plan to walk on water as an encore?"
"Shut up," Braun said shakily. The two syllables sounded almost affectionate. She rested a while and then found that the easiest way to get the still-weak poet down the steps and across the glass-strewn floor of the Shrike Palace was to use the fireman's carry. They were at the entrance when he pounded unceremoniously on her back and said,
"What about King Billy and the others?"
"Later," panted Braun and stepped out into the pre-dawn light. She had hobbled down 2/3 of the valley with Silenus draped over her shoulders like so much limp laundry when the poet said,
"Braun, are you still pregnant?"
"Yes," she said, praying that that was still true after the day's exertions.
"You want me to carry you?"
"Shut up," she said, and followed the path down and around the jade tomb.
"Look,"
said Martin Silenus, twisting to point even as he hung almost upside down over her shoulder. In the glowing light of morning, Braun could see that the consul's ebony spacecraft now sat on the high ground at the entrance to the valley. But that was not what the poet was pointing toward. Saul Weintraub stood silhouetted in the glare of the Sphinx's entrance. His arms were raised. Someone or something was emerging from the glare. Saul saw her first, a figure walking amidst the torrent of light and liquid time flowing from the Sphinx. A woman, he saw, as she was silhouetted against the brilliant portal. A woman carrying something. A woman carrying an infant. His daughter Rachel emerged. Rachel, as he had last seen her as a healthy young adult, leaving to do her doctoral work on some world called Hyperion. Rachel, in her mid-20s. Perhaps even a bit older now, but Rachel. No doubt about that. Rachel, with her copperish brown hair still short and falling across her forehead. Her cheeks flushed as they always were, as with some new enthusiasm. Her smile soft, almost tremulous now. And her eyes, those enormous green eyes with specks of brown just visible. Those eyes fixed on Saul. Rachel was carrying Rachel. The infant squirmed with its face against the young woman's shoulder, tiny hands clenching and unclenching as it tried to decide whether to start crying again or not. Saul stood stunned. He tried to speak, failed, and tried again.
"Rachel."
"Father," said the young woman, and stepped forward, putting her free arm around the scholar, while she turned slightly to keep the baby from being crushed between them. Saul kissed his grown daughter, hugged her, smelled the clean scent of her hair, felt the firm reality of her, and then lifted the infant to his own neck and shoulder, feeling the shudders pass through the newborn as she took a breath before crying. The Rachel he had brought to Hyperion was safe in his hands, small, red face wrinkled as she tried to focus her randomly wandering eyes on her father's face. Saul cupped her tiny head in his palm and lifted her closer, inspecting that small face for a second, before turning toward the young woman.
"Is she?"
"She's aging normally," said his daughter. She was wearing something, part gown, part robe, made of soft brown material. Saul shook his head, looked at her, saw her smiling, and noticed the same small dimple below and to the left of her mouth that was visible on the infant he held. He shook his head again.
How is this possible?"
"It's not for very long," said Rachel. Saul leaned forward and kissed his grown daughter's cheek again. He realized that he was crying, but he would not release either hand to wipe away the tears. His grown Rachel did so for him, touching his cheek gently with the back of her hand. There was a noise below them on the steps, and Saul looked over his shoulder to see the three men from the ship standing there, red-faced from running, and Braun Lamia helping the poet Silenus to a seat on the white slab of railing stone. The consul and Theo Lane looked up at them.
"Rachel," whispered Melio Arendez, his eyes filling.
"Rachel,"
said Martin Silenus, frowning and glancing at Braun Lamia. Braun was staring with her mouth half open.
"Moneta,"
she said, pointing, then lowering her hand as she realized she was pointing.
"You're Moneta. Kassad's Moneta."
Rachel nodded, her smile gone.
"I have only a minute or two here," she said, "and much to tell you."
"No," said Saul, taking his grown daughter's hand. "You have to stay. I want you to stay with me."
Rachel smiled again. "I will stay with you, Dad," she said softly, raising her other hand to touch the baby's head.
"But only one of us can. And she needs you more."
She turned to the group below.
"Listen, please, all of you."
As the sun rose and touched the broken buildings of the poet's city, the consul's ship, the western cliffs, and the taller time tombs with its light, Rachel told her brief and tantalizing story of being chosen to be raised in a future where the final war raged between the core-spawned UI and the human spirit. It was, she said, a future of terrifying and wonderful mysteries, where humankind had spread across this galaxy and had begun to travel elsewhere.
"Other galaxies?" asked Theo Lane.
"Other universes," smiled Rachel.
"Colonel Kassad knew you as Moneta," said Martin Silenus.
"Will know me as Moneta," she said, her eyes clouding. "I have seen him die, and accompanied his tomb to the past. I know that part of my mission is to meet this fabled warrior and lead him forward to the final battle. I have not truly met him yet."
She looked down the valley toward the crystal monolith.
"Moneta," she mused. "It means admonisher in Latin. appropriate. I will let him choose between that and Mnemosyne, memory, for my name. Saul had not released his daughter's hand. He did not do so now.
You're traveling back in time?